This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Well, hello, good afternoon to you. Very glad you could spend some time here on Friday's edition of the Country Hour. Today, the WA grain industry, it is on track to harvest a record crop, 27.2 million tonnes. That beats the last record crop back in 2022 with a total of 25.4 million tonnes. So basically up almost 2 million tonnes on the previous record. Michael Lamond along shortly to go through the details of that for you. And also the price of nickel, off to a good start for 2026. Prices up 20% in the last month. So we'll look at the reasons behind that shortly with Tim Treadgold, who's an industry commentator. 12:06 here on the Country Hour. Well, 2026 has started with a bang for wool growers, with the first week of sales for the new year seeing the benchmark Eastern Market Indicator up 107 cents to close at 1,648 cents a kilogram clean. That is the strongest start to wool sales since 2011. Josh Lamb is the trading manager of Endeavour Wool Exports, which is Australia's second biggest wool exporter based out of Victoria. Josh, what happened this week?
Well, we certainly saw some pretty good inquiry from China over the Christmas recess. We had 3 weeks of no wool sales, and that inquiry was building as the recess went along. Prior to that, the month leading into the recess, the market was heading in the right direction. There were certainly some good signs there then, but just a lot of that pent-up inquiry from China with no wool sales for a few weeks certainly materialised on Tuesday with the significant lifts we've seen, and that's off the back of better demand out of China.
So what sort of signals and indicators were you getting during that period where there were no wool sales during the break?
So what happens during the break, usually with the forward sellers, the exporters that sell out of positions to China, you start to make some offers early in the recess. What you start to see is prices start to go off a little bit. You might offer a little bit higher the next day or the day after that, and then you all of a sudden they're accepting a slightly higher price again. So then you can start to see the trends moving up towards better prices. Off the back of that, you do get exporters will eventually sell out of the stock they've got. And of course, once that happened over the recess off the back of supply concerns, China started to pick up the pace a little bit. And then they're starting to bid prices over the market or over the market close prior to the recess. So, you know, that then translates into a better market this week.
So you weren't surprised at all about the results of the sales this week? This was completely to be expected from what you were hearing during the break.
Yeah, look, the last sale before the break, we weren't expecting this sort of lift. We thought it would open positive, but it was a bit early to tell at that stage. But most of the industry, or most of our side of the trade, so the exporters, were expecting a dearer market this week, probably a little bit more than what we had initially thought. But those prices have been able to, well, those rises have been able to be passed on to mills in China. So that's pretty good for the fundamentals of the market. It means they're accepting that price, and that the market should consolidate at these levels.
All right. So it's not just a blip in the market. It's just, this is something fundamental going forward.
Yeah, I don't think it's a blip. I think September, the rises we had late September, early October, probably for the wrong reasons. There was definitely panic buying going on in China at that stage around supply concerns coming out of the Nanjing conference. This rise, to me, feels a lot more solid than that. There is genuine demand increase in China behind it. And that's what you want to see when you get a market rise. You know, supply is still a big issue for the industry here and overseas with processors, not just in China, but in Europe and other countries as well. So that's definitely lingering in the background. But now we're starting to see proper demand pull through. And when those two things cross, you're getting a market like we've had this week that jumps over 100 cents in a day.
How do you think wool growers would be interpreting what they're seeing at the market this week?
Oh, look, I'd like to think they're seeing it as a positive, but, you know, look at the market over the last 25 years. We've ridden these waves and dips more often than we'd probably care to remember, I think. But I do think overall, though, growers should see it as a positive. We're not producing enough wool in the world, particularly in Australia now, for the amount of processing capacity we have around the world, particularly in China. And you've got to think that supply concern is going to be nagging at the market for the next couple of years. So, you know, I think growers will be naturally sceptical because of what they've been through in recent years. But at the same time, I do think they've got to take positives out of it, that the market is moving to a new level, and hopefully it's going to maintain these levels medium term to give the industry a chance to sort of renew itself here.
Well, some growers have already made the decision, haven't they, Josh? I mean, here in Western Australia, the figure, the projections is our flock's going to be down around, you know, maybe even 8 million head and dropping rapidly over the last few years due to a range of different reasons, which we don't have time to go into now. But, I mean, that's the reality.
No, that's right. And you and I talked about it last year, but it's been the biggest concern for the industry in the last, probably over the last 15 years, but particularly the last two, where that acceleration of people leaving the wool part of the industry has been quite alarming. And this, you know, this rise won't necessarily stop all that either, but it might just give a few people a bit of food for thought when they start to join this year, that maybe the wool part of it does have a bit better future. But, you know, the clip's certainly going to keep declining this year. The eastern side of the country is still very dry, and that's going to have an effect on numbers as well.
And so for next week then, what are your predictions? Like rises like we've seen this week, or more of it just a consolidation of this week?
No, I think we'll definitely consolidate around these levels next week. We've got a slightly bigger offering, which will put a bit more wool into the market and give mills a chance to get more of what they want. But I see the market consolidating next week, but it generally looks pretty positive over the next couple of months.
Good to talk to you, Josh. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Belinda.
Josh Lamb, he's the trading manager of Endeavour Wool Exports based in Victoria. And, of course, as we do on a Friday, we will look at the wool market in a little more detail just before the news at 1 o'clock. Andrew Beaton will be along to talk through the market. As I mentioned, the Eastern Market Indicator, the benchmark in the wool industry, is up 107 cents this week, closing at 1,648 cents a kilo clean. And here in the West, the Western Market Indicator up 131 cents to finish the week on 1,846 cents a kilo clean. As I said, all the details just before the news at 1 o'clock. 12 past 12. Well, the nickel price is also starting the year strong, with prices up 20% in the last month. Now, while that sounds impressive, industry commentator Tim Treadgold doesn't believe it will be enough to restart some of the dozens of nickel mines which have been shuttered across WA. He says the nickel price is a direct result of decisions coming out of Indonesia.
Indonesia, which has been the big interference in the nickel market by overproducing to satisfy demands from Chinese steel mills and battery makers, has woken to the fact that what's happening only benefited China. So Indonesia, the government there, has said, no, we're going to crack down on all these nickel mines and force them to abide by their quotas. The result is that there's a feeling in the market that the volume of nickel coming out of Indonesia is going to fall quite substantially, possibly by as much as 35%. And the result is that the nickel price has gone from, I'll do this in US dollars if you don't mind, $14,200 a tonne to now trade at $18,513 a tonne. That's a very substantial uplift caused entirely by Indonesian policy change.
Yeah, and as you say, it's sort of almost 20% over the last month. And is that sustainable? Because we were expecting there was going to be oversupply sort of up until 2028, 29. Is that still the case?
The question of sustainability applies as much to the nickel price as it does to Indonesian government policy. Will the government stick to its policy? Will it enforce its policy? It's a very tricky one. If you were an investor, private or corporate, wanting to get into nickel, you would have a look at it and say, gee, this metal's a worry. It goes up and down at a rapid rate. I don't want to be caught on the next downturn. And I think people are wary about getting too deep into nickel again because we've been here before.
We have. And as you say, those cycles seem to be relatively short from the peaks to peaks and troughs to troughs. I think I've seen some commentary saying it's around 8 years, and yet we do have a number of mines in Western Australia that are sitting idle. I mean, will this be enough to reawaken them?
Every mine on its own merits, and what we don't know is what's happened to costs in those structures, so those mines. So if we go and look at Pigo Nickel Mine in WA, and I can't think of one off the top of my head. But
well, let's talk about Ravensthorpe or something like that.
Ravensthorpe's a classic, isn't it?
That's
been up and down like a yo-yo. It was doomed from the day it started because it wasn't built well. BHP built it but got things wrong. Other owners have come in and haven't been able to fix it. So you've now got it back on the market. I think the Canadian company First Quantum, which is very closely associated with the Perth family, by the way, they are mulling getting out altogether. They've got a Korean partner in there that might pick it up at a bargain basement price. But the question from people in Ravensthorpe or in that area want to know is, does it actually signify the reopening of the mine? The only answer to that is possibly. It depends on how brave the new owner is and whether they're prepared to ride out a very damaging, very dangerous, very wild cycle of pricing. I mean, if I was involved, I wouldn't go near it with a barge pole because nickel has just destroyed so much value in the state. Yes, we can produce it. Can we make profits out of it? No.
The major owners of the Ravensthorpe Nickel Mine, being First Quantum, owning 70%, have publicly said on their social media that they're not for sale. Do you feel like there is still something going on in the background, though, Tim?
Of course it is. I mean, if you look at that nickel price, the guys who run First Quantum will be looking at it and saying, oh, yippee beans, we can either get back into business or we can flog it to someone who's keener than us to own it. I've no doubt they've given Andrew Forrest a call since he seems to be buying all the nickel assets around the place. And say, have we got a deal for you? Now, whether Andrew wants to get in or not, I mean, Andrew's been on a one-man crusade for about 25 or 30 years now to prove that he can produce nickel profitably after his disastrous experience with Anaconda Nickel. Mm. So he could be a logical buyer. He might want to get back in. I don't think anybody else is really serious about it.
And, of course, we know that Ravensthorpe Nickel Operations is 30% owned by a South Korean conglomerate as well. You would think that maybe if somebody was interested in the Raven Nickel Operations, maybe they'd be looking at what else is around, though, wouldn't you, Tim? I mean, Nickel West's had their data room open for a few months now. I mean, what would be a more, I suppose, enticing opportunity, do you think?
A consistent and steady price for nickel. From an investment perspective, you can't put your money into an asset which moves so violently in price. You'd be a brave man to put your money on it going back to where it was in the good old days because of Indonesia. Indonesia is able to produce vast amounts of nickel. And just because the government has said, slow down, doesn't mean they're going to slow down. The Chinese owners of those projects will find a way to crank them up somehow.
So does it feel like this latest jump, and I mean it is a significant jump in prices comparatively from a very low base, but does it feel like it's just that? It's a small jump and nobody's really going to follow?
No, it is a substantial jump, but it's a substantial jump for an odd reason. It's not as if demand for nickel has suddenly increased, and demand is the key to any asset. It's because of a big government foot being put on supply. Now, that big government foot can be removed anytime you like.
Resource markets commentator Tim Treadgold, he was speaking to Tara de Langraft, 19 past 12.
This is the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
The WA grain industry is on track to harvest a record crop, with the final crop report for the 2025 season due out next month. Now, the last record crop was back in 2022, with a total harvest of 25.4 million tonnes. This year is going to be up a couple of million tonnes on that. Michael Lamond is the author of the Grain Industry Association of WA Crop Report, and he's here with an interim report on this year's harvest. Michael, what is the state expected to put in the bins this season?
Yeah, okay, Belinda. Well, harvest is nearly wrapped up, or deliveries are pretty well wrapped up. There'll be a bit more trickling in over the next week possibly, but At the moment, you know, according to CBH's deliveries, there's, you know, around about 24 million tonne of total grain being delivered to CBH. So when you add on seed that's retained on farm for, you know, for sowing in 26 and storage for, you know, a lot of the minor crops, you know, like say oats and lupins particularly, and barley, and also some of the, you know, the pulses, often those aren't, there's a lot of that isn't delivered. Some is warehoused in CBH, but you need to add on about another 3 million tonnes to that. So it looks like, you know, if you allow for a little bit more grain delivery to CBH over the next week or so, it looks like there's probably going to be around about 27.2 million tonnes of total grain produced, which is a couple of million tonnes more than 22.
Incredible, isn't it? I mean, if we go back to the start of the season to planting and the sort of journey from there to here, did you ever expect it to reach just over 27 million tonnes?
Oh, no, I don't think anyone did. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it wasn't a particularly good start. It was in the south, but it wasn't, you know, for the north, particularly in that Geraldton zone, you know, where it was a very late start. You know, Geraldton produced about 4.3 million tonne of grain in 22, which was an exceptionally good year there, and it was a record then. This year, they'll probably be about 5 million tonnes. So that's, you know, it's quite an incredible. I mean, Geraldton did have a very good year last year. 23 was very ordinary for them. So when you consider the lateness of the start, particularly as you go north in the state, where, you know, it's just unheard of getting those sort of yields, because, you know, we normally end up with heat shock and think, you know, and it's only heat shock really that you know, puts a lid on the total tons, particularly with the late planting. So no, I don't think anyone could have foreseen that. I mean, you know, I mean, it has been exceptional in those good areas. It's still, you know, probably to keep in mind, the central areas haven't been overly, they're certainly not in record territory, but, you know, I suppose, you know, every year, say 4 out of the last 5 years have been record tonnages, and each of those years there's been areas of the state that haven't been particularly good either. So,
well, let's compare what's happened this year, this season. For 2025, we've got what looks like 27.2 million tonnes in the bin, and go back to the previous record set in 2022 when the state harvested 25.4 million tonnes. How do you compare and contrast those 2 years?
Well, I mean, they're similar and they're different. I mean, 22 was a much earlier start. There was subsoil moisture. It was, the crops went in earlier. It did have a mild finish, similar to 25. You know, so in some respects, there was sort of similarities. I mean, in 25, you know, the southern areas, right up into various regions in the central area, did get a nice early start, although vastly different in the central and northern areas of the state from 22, where, you know, the start was very late. The other thing, I suppose, is that similar to 22, the mild finish, not a lot of frost. There was a bit more frost in 25 than 22. That certainly took the lid off in the central areas, quite a lot, in fact. And, you know, probably a million tonne of frost, you know, in 25 compared to virtually nothing in 22. The mild temperatures, you know, what seems to be happening was, particularly in these last 5 years, we've had 4 record years out of the last 5, is that the season seems to, well, not so much in 22, but the other years, the seasons have seemed to have moved back about a month. And so we're getting these milder temperatures, you know, in the spring during grainfill, which are having a huge difference on, you know, in potential tonnes that you can grow. The other one is there's more crop area sown in 25 than 22. In 22, there was about 8.96 million hectares sown of total crop in the state. In 25, there was about 9.44. So about a half million tonne more area went in, and most of that was in that higher rainfall areas where the yields are higher. And, you know, so, I mean, in 22, the central areas of the state were very good. This year, in 25, they weren't. Most of the yield, the really good yields were in the perimeter of the grain belt, sort of the South Esperance, South Coast, West Albany, West Coast and Geraldton, where the central regions weren't particularly good, and a lot of growers certainly didn't have yet record yields there, whereas in 22 they did. So, you know, I suppose, yeah, the extra 2 million tonnes was made up due to, you know, probably extra area. Geraldton was particularly good. You know, there was 700,000 tonnes more grown in, there will be 700,000 tonnes more grown in 25 and 22 in Geraldton, which has had a huge impact as well. And there, so the extra area, the extra tonnage grown in Geraldton have made up for probably the very average years in the central regions.
Now, I know, you know, you mentioned the extra area that's gone in this year, and that's obviously made a difference. But, I mean, isn't it still quite incredible the amount of grain that is coming off here in Western Australia consistently?
Yeah, well, I suppose when you say consistent, yeah, like there's an extra 5 million tonne getting, you know, in the last 5 years, except for 23, there's been, you know, up to 5 million tonnes more than the previous averages, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it is quite incredible. Of course, it is, a lot of it is due to season, not so much total rainfall, but it's the getting a little bit of rain in the spring has a massive impact. Not having the high temperatures in the spring has a massive impact. But it's also due to a whole heap of other things like practice change. You know, there's a lot of practice change occurring. There's growers are now using 30% more fertiliser than they did 5 years ago, like in 2021. Since 21, the last 5 years, there's 30% more fertiliser used. Now, that's not just due to the extra area gone in. It's they're using more per hectare. So it's that calculated risk to try and achieve these high yields in when you do have a good year is growers are making much better use of the rainfall that falls than they did even 5 years ago, which is, so that's quite a dramatic practice change that's occurred. And there's other things as well, of course, you know, not just the fertiliser use.
No, it's really impressive. Look, thank you for the update. I know this is just an interim update at this point, and we're going to be talking again in a few weeks' time for the final GIWA crop report. But I really appreciate the update on how we're sort of shaping up for this season. Good to talk to you, Michael.
Okay. Good day then, Belinda. Bye.
Michael Lamond, he's the author of the Grain Industry Association of WA Crop Report, just giving you a little interim update on what the WA grain industry is on track to produce for season 2025 as far as the grain crop goes. Looks like being a total harvest of 27.2 million tonnes. That's up almost 2 million tonnes on the previous record in 2022, which recorded 25.4 million tonnes, 27 past 12. Let's just head over to northwest Queensland now, where graziers are still counting the cost of the floods, with around 65,000 livestock reported missing or dead. And there could be more rain on the way as ex-tropical cyclone Koji moves west across the state, where some catchments are already saturated. Northwest Queensland grazier Dudley Harrington says more rain is the last thing they want to see for their livestock.
People are out here on cattle stations because of their love of animals. And they love this industry. They love working with cattle and livestock. And people take a lot of pride in their cattle and their bloodlines and their breeding. And it can take generations to build up a herd the way you would like it. And then to see them getting washed down a river, or see them dying in, along a fence line or something bogged, it's pretty heartbreaking. It's a tough thing to go through. It'll be a very tough sort of 12 months for this region rebuilding from that. It's going to take us probably the whole year to get an idea of losses. We're definitely seeing losses, especially in young cattle, as we get around large calf losses, obviously due to the how wet it got and how long it was. Paddocks that went completely underwater with flood water and just not seeing many cattle there. And it didn't seem to matter whether you had flood water or not, because a lot of cattle just sort of couldn't handle the prolonged wet and the cold weather. So bogging and the illnesses and that come with standing in water and mud for a long time has set in, and that's probably contributing to those losses just as much as the floodwaters is the exposure to those elements.
There's potentially some more rain coming from this ex-tropical cyclone. Can you and the people in your region take another downpour?
Short answer is no. We're very wet. The creek systems are all full. The river systems are full. This is our wet season. We like to see rain now. It's normal for us to be getting rain, but just at the moment, the ground's so wet, the rivers are so full already. And for those cattle that have been standing in water for a couple of weeks now and mud, they really need a chance to dry out. So another system coming through now, look, it might be the last straw for a lot of cattle.
Now, obviously, this has a financial impact for a lot of people, but what is the personal toll?
Yeah, it's a huge physical and mental toll on everyone at the moment. This is sort of our wet season time. There's skeleton staff up here. A lot of cattle stations have got very few people on them. So, yeah, it's taking a huge effort. I've just found our local community has really rallied together. A lot of businesses in town done a huge support us in the last couple of weeks. A lot of people have volunteered their time, getting flown out to stations to help people, carting avgas and hay and things like that. Has been predominantly done by people that run their own businesses and that from town. People haven't stopped yet to fully comprehend what effects it's going to have, and it's going to be a long, drawn out sort of few months and year to try and recover from it.
Dudley Harrington, who runs Warinna Cattle Station, that's in northwest Queensland, and he's talking about the situation after all that floodwaters and the situation they're dealing with all those livestock. 65,000 head of livestock reported missing or dead. And he was talking to Abby Holter. 29 to 1, Jonathan Hopper is in the studio. He's got the news headlines for you.
Good afternoon, Belinda. The Foreign Minister is urging Australians in Iran to leave if they can do so safely amid a brutal crackdown against protesters. Donald Trump has temporarily walked back the threat of US military action amid assurances from Iran that it has stopped mass killings. Around 700 Western power customers in the wheat belt are experiencing an unplanned power outage as temperatures are set to reach 40 degrees today. Residents in and around 2J have been without power since about 9 o'clock this morning and don't expect to be connected until 5 p.m. The Western Power website says a ground patrol crew is attending the outage location. And the Dockers have announced their leadership group for 2026, with defender Alex Pearce retaining the captaincy. The 30-year-old fullback will continue to be supported by co-vice captains Caleb Sarong and Andrew Brayshaw. 25-year-old defender Jordan Clark is the new addition to the leadership group off the back of a career best season last year. Thanks, Belinda.
Thank you for the update, Jonathan. Appreciate that. 28 to 1. And this hour we've been talking about the record grain harvest that Western Australia is on track for. And Michael Lamond, who is the author of the Giwa Crop Report, was saying that it looks like this harvest, because some people are still harvesting, although it is only a handful, so it's not going to make a huge difference to the total. But at this point, he thinks the grand total will be 27.2 million tonnes. Now, on the text, Neil says the total grain harvest is bigger than you are reporting. What about the other grain traders like Bungie in Bunbury? Well, actually, Michael does take that into account, Neil, because it looks like CBH has got around about 24 million tonnes. So there's that extra 3-ish million tonnes that adds up to be a statewide total of 27.2 million tonnes. Also, this from Mark: the reason there is record-breaking harvest is due to farmers getting out of sheep due to the unpopular live sheep export ban and a lot more land put under crop, and it's going to get bigger. Thank you, Mark. And Jim says the size of the seeding and harvesting machinery is so much bigger now. Maybe 20 years ago, it would have been physically impossible to achieve these monster harvests. Be part of the conversation. 0448 922 604 is the text if you want to have your say. Shortly, heading off to the Bureau of Meteorology.
Thank you.
26 to 1 here on the country on the ABC WA and streaming live on the ABC Listen app. Making our way now to the Bureau of Meteorology, Catherine Shelfout is with you this afternoon. Catherine, should we start with a look at northern and eastern parts of the state today? Because particularly around this tropical low, what are the chances of that low forming in the north of the state?
No worries. I thought you might want to start up there. There's a bit of interest. So just to start with, we've had some decent rainfall yesterday up around Kununurra, 60 to 75 millimetres with some thunderstorms around, and they're still sort of ticking through. So expect to see more of that today in the next few days, and they do come with the chance of some damaging winds. Might not see as much rainfall as we got yesterday, but it is a chance. But yes, we have... we expect to see a developing tropical low. So at the moment, we're monitoring over the Northern Territory, and this will be 16U. So we just give them a number as we go along to keep track. So we expect that tropical low to form over the Northern Territory and then move west. So currently it's assessed that there's a moderate chance of that system becoming a tropical cyclone on Monday. So for people in the north, watch out. We have to wait and see how it goes, where it forms today, and then how it starts to move. So we may issue a severe weather warning, or if we can see that it's looking more likely to become a cyclone, then you might see a tropical cyclone watch issued over the weekend. So given we won't talk to you on Country Hour till Monday, best for people to keep an eye on that. In the longer term, most of the models are suggesting the system will move over waters north of the Kimberley and generally in a westward sort of movement. But there's a lot of uncertainty. So all our hundreds of ensemble models, big broad range of where it's taking the system. In the longer term, we could see impacts for the Western Kimberley or for the Pilbara coast and inland. But basically, the longer the system stays over water, the more likely it is to become more intense. So big range of scenarios still possible. So just, keep an eye on the forecast with that one over the weekend and early next week. Elsewhere in the north of the state, really hot through the Pilbara and the interior and the northern Gascoyne. That's continuing for the foreseeable future. We do have some temperature forecasts in the 49 to 50 range for the western Pilbara and northwest Gascoyne on Tuesday and Wednesday. So pretty uncomfortable conditions, but still some thunderstorms possible throughout pretty much all of the north over the coming few days.
Well, let's move into the Southwest Land Division. Pretty hot across, a large part of that division this afternoon.
It is, and I just heard on the news you're talking about the power outages, so pretty uncomfortable through the wheat belt today. Temperatures there into the 40s and also quite windy, but cooler near the west coast today because that west coast trough is moving inland. We have had some storms down near the south coast around Albany, Esperance. They're moving offshore, but expect to see some storms firing up again anywhere from the Pilbara down to the south coast this afternoon. From tomorrow, we'll see that trough moving east over the goldfields and a low moving south of the state, and we'll have a ridge pushing in over the southwest corner. So we will see more west-southwesterly winds, moderate sort of strength over most of the Southwest Land Division, and so temperatures will drop. So we've got temperatures around 25 degrees all along the west coast from sort of Lancelin down to Margaret River and sitting in the low to mid-30s for the Wheat Belt and other inland parts of the Central West and the Great Southern. So that's a bit cooler than we've had for a few days. Just a few millimetres of rain possible around from about Augusta to Albany and inland to Manjimup tomorrow, and still a thunderstorm risk, but mostly for far eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division, so east of about Caliberran to Hopetown tomorrow. On Sunday, the weather's mainly driven by a new ridge moving in along the south coast and sitting over southern districts, and just a really weak high pressure system south of Albany. So winds will mainly be light southeasterly, and we will see sea breezes near the west and the south coasts. So temperatures remaining a bit cooler than average for this time of the year, looking at temps around 21 for Albany and 25 for Mount Barker and Ravensthorpe, and just a chance of a light shower between Albany and Israelite Bay. Monday and Tuesday, we won't see any precipitation across the southwest land division, or we're not forecasting any. We'll have just that ridge and high sort of dominating and the west coast trough redeveloping. So winds will be light southeasterly initially, but we will see a bit of a southeasterly surge moving through Monday night. And then on Tuesday, winds turn more easterly and a little bit stronger. So not much of a sea breeze near the west coast, which means we're going for 41 in Perth on Tuesday, 45 at Mullewa and 42 at Dalwallinu. So Tuesday and Wednesday looking like being the hottest days in the cycle at this stage.
Catherine, thank you so much. 20 minutes to one. Taking a look at the rain that's fallen across WA in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, checking 5 millimetres and over, and starting in northern and eastern forecast districts. In the Kimberley, Broome Airport 39, Charnley River 6, Signet Bay 23, Diggers Rest 33, Faraway Bay 75, Halls Creek Airport 20, Kalumburoo 33, Kununurra Aero 54, Kununurra Checkpoint 16, Kununurra 58, Lansdowne 5, Lombardina Aero 7, Moolabulla Airstrip 12, Mount House Airstrip 35, Old Mornington Homestead 14, Wagina Gorge 10, Wyndham Aero 33, and Yappy Sound 15, and nothing over 5 mils in the southwest land division. Due to today's risk of fire, there is a total fire ban in place for quite a few local government areas across the Great Southern, Midwest, Wheat Belt, and southwest regions. There are too many to read out, so make sure you head to the Emergency WA website for the full list of the areas affected. You'll also see a detailed list of what you can and can't do during a total fire ban. Now, there is also a number of harvest bans in place today, and that includes the shires of Bridgetown Greenbushes, Broomhill Tambalup, Boyup Brook, Kubaling, Katanning, Kendinnan, Corder, Training, Yilgarn, Meriden, West Arthur, Woodenilling and Wonganballadue. Remember, it is your responsibility to check with your local shire if there is a harvest and vehicle movement ban in place. Just repeating, there's a total fire ban for a number of local government areas in the Great Southern, Midwest and Wheat Belt and southwest regions. Head to the Emergency WA website for a full list of affected areas. 18 to 1. Well, farmers and pastoralists in the Kimberley are facing financial losses and safety risks with a key weather radar expected to be offline for 3 months. Lightning struck the Bureau of Meteorology's radar for Wyndham on Christmas Day, sparking a fire and causing considerable damage. And there is currently no radar coverage in areas across Wyndham, Kununurra, Lake Argyle, and the Lower Ord River. Kununurra farmer Matt Gray says a working radar is vital at this time of year.
Critical, yeah. Like we'd find ourselves using, accessing the radar 10 or more times a day, whether that's planting, spraying or fertilising. So being the wet season, there's very limited opportunities to plant and making the most of those opportunities by seeing where the storms are coming from and how far away they are plays a critical role in all those three things. And yeah, whether it's having a fertiliser truck stuck out in the paddock or mixing up a tank of spray which needs to be put out the day it's mixed, we use the radar to make all those decisions.
How much of a difference does a few hours warning make when you're planting?
It's all the difference, yeah. If you're doing sort of what everyone's operation's different, but if you're doing 10 hectares an hour, it's the difference between maybe starting another paddock or waiting and seeing what the weather does. If you start a paddock and there's rain on the horizon and you get 10 hectares into it and it rains and you got a week or 2 week gap in that paddock, then it's less than ideal. It just makes life easier, put it that way. It helps with decision making. Obviously, whenever there's an outage of any sort, whether that's farm machinery or in this case the radar, you just work around it, but it's definitely easier with it. And then it definitely encourages the Bureau to rethink why it's going to take 3 months to fix it.
So with the radar down as it is currently, what are you doing? How do you predict the rain? Are you just looking to the sky or what are your methods?
Just look to the sky and I suppose be a lot more alert because you have a more limited time to react.
Does this slow you down or does it push you into taking bigger risks?
Just bigger risks, yep. So if you're, let's say you're putting out a tank of spray and might be $5,000 to $10,000 worth of chemical in that tank and yeah, you only and needs some chemicals need 6 hours rain fast. So if you can't see when it's going to rain, then and you mix it up and spray it out, and that rains 2 hours later, then that's your money gone.
So if this outage runs the full 3 months, which the Bureau has predicted, what could that mean for this season's crop?
It won't have any detrimental effects on the crop. Obviously, there'll just be those small hiccups along the way. But, it's a tool that we've all become accustomed to using and plays a critical role in decision-making. So it's definitely helpful to have it. And, time will tell as to what the cost of it is. But, yeah, I suppose you can't quantify it until it's been and gone.
Have you experienced this kind of outage before, a months-long potentially outage?
Not in my time. It's always going in and out, like you might lose it for a week, but for them to say it's going to be down for 3 months is, pretty hard to imagine what could possibly be wrong with it that they can't fix it within that shorter time frame. But yeah, I think and people have become so used to it, and whether you're just a weather watcher and like to look at the storms and where they come from, or you actually do use it as part of your business, either way, it has become quite important and is relied on heavily. So I'd encourage the Bureau to reassess as to what resources they need to put into getting it going again.
Matt Gray, who owns Serez Farm in Kununurra, which produces a range of crops including cotton, watermelon and pumpkins. Pastoralist Alida Woodland says the radar being offline isn't just inconvenient, it's also a safety issue.
By the time they have it fixed, we're probably not going to need it much anymore for several months. For us, it's really important because we can look at it and see what's following in the catchment area for the King River, because we have a major river crossing that keeps us from getting into town when it's up. And it can take well over 24 hours for some of that rain to come down through the catchment. And if we don't know what's fallen in the catchment, you know, we can get caught. It affects us in that way. It's, you know, it's back to the way it was, you know, 25, 30 years ago when we would get the image on the fax machine. Which didn't do much good. So there's that. And then just a couple of days ago, we had a really powerful storm come through, and we didn't have any sense of it. You know, usually you see things building up, but this just hit us really quickly and took out some trees in the paddocks and around the houses. So it would have been nice to have a bit of a heads up with that one.
Yeah, what's the danger of not knowing when storms like that are coming through?
I suppose, you know, we've gotten used to being able to check the radar and say, okay, well, we need to go and make sure everything's, you know, put under cover. And so it's buildings, equipment, that sort of thing. The animals are out open range anyway, so they're on their own. But it is good to have a heads up to know, like if you've been out on the tractor doing something, you know, maybe you need to go and make sure everything's weighted down, or if you've been moving stuff around, it's really helpful.
How much do you normally rely on the radar when you're planning your day? Is it a part of your routine? Do you check it every morning? Or
yeah, we get up in the morning, we look and say, okay, well, looks like we've got a good several hours before it's going to rain, so we can go out and do some spraying. We have an invasive plant on the property that we're constantly battling, and if we don't know if there's rain close by, then it can mess up the spraying for the day if we think, oh, it's okay, and then the next thing we know it's raining.
What do you fall back on instead when the radar is down?
I just look at the sky a lot. What else can you do? Look at the satellite imagery, the clouds, but that's about it. You don't really have anything that's anywhere close to fall back onto.
Is there anything that you would want to say to the Bureau about having the radar offline for this long, for the predicted 3 months?
I feel like it should be more of a priority. Maybe it is a priority. Maybe they cannot do it within 3 months, but you know, everybody knows they just spent tens of millions of dollars on their new website. And I know, you know, we're a remote area, but we're in the tropics. We get extreme weather up here. It'd be nice if, you know, they could prioritize it, I suppose. I hope they have. I don't know. I mean, you know, we'll survive. We'll get by fine, but it is a huge inconvenience and a bit of a safety issue.
Co-owner of Diggers Rest Station, Alida Woodland, 11 minutes to 1. Bureau meteorologist Jessica Lingard says assessments of the radar are continuing, but the damage is severe enough to warrant a three-month repair job.
There has been really significant damage. So if it was sort of a typical outage where a single point of failure has occurred, those are usually a relatively quick fix that the technicians are able to resolve quite quickly. But unfortunately, the extent of damage is still being assessed at this stage, and it is going to be quite an extensive recovery period for us to get this system back online. Radars are very complex, very costly and unique pieces of infrastructure, and it is going to take a little while to get it back up and running and back up to full functioning.
So there needs to be an assessment completed before any works can take place, is that right?
Yeah, so we have already done some preliminary assessments. Obviously, we know that it was struck by lightning. We know that there was a fire, but we're still in the stage of assessing how much damage has been caused by that fire and how many parts of that radar are going to be able to be saved and put back into service, and how many parts of that radar are going to need to be replaced.
Some have reported that the radar was offline before Christmas Day for all of December, some reports are saying. So was there an outage that preceded the current one?
Yeah, there was an outage with the Rindam radar that was reported in early December as well, I think on about the 13th. I'm not quite sure what happened there. It did come back online, but obviously it was very only briefly that it was back online before it did sustain that more significant damage on Christmas Day.
Farmers and station owners in the Kimberley both depend quite heavily on the radar, especially now for farmers as they're heading into the planting season, and they're saying they're now just looking at the sky really to predict rain. Is there anything practical that people can lean on while the radar's down?
Oh, absolutely. The radar is one of the most useful pieces of equipment that the Bureau has, especially for community members who rely on it as a source of how to track rain and thunderstorms, especially during the wet season and the tropical cyclone season for the north of Australia. So we definitely empathise with those folks who are struggling without it. The Bureau is impacted by that as well, and obviously we would prefer to have it up online rather than being offline. There are surrounding radars that obviously don't completely match what the Wyndham radar has. We've got the radar at Halls Creek, at Broome and at Darwin. If you use the radar online, you can sort of zoom out to that sort of composite 512-kilometre view, and that will give you that composite of all three of those additional radars to give you a bit of an idea of what's going on. The other sort of technique that I like to use when areas that don't have radar coverage, because there is quite a large area of Australia that is not covered by radars, is to use the satellite loop. So the satellite is a geostationary satellite based up in 36,000 kilometres north of the equator, and every 10 minutes it's taking a picture of the globe. So we have this 24-hour-a-day coverage by this satellite, and on the Bureau's website, on the satellite layer, you can actually toggle on and off the lightning feature. So that we also have other satellites and monitoring equipment that monitor lightning flashes and plot them on top of the satellite imagery. So this is also a really handy way of monitoring those thunderstorms that you might normally be able to track on radar. You can also track them on the satellite imagery.
From the Bureau of Meteorology, that's Jessica Lingard speaking to Jess Baker. And if you want to read more about this story, Jess has got one up for you right now online. Just search Bomb Radar Kimberley ABC and you'll see Jess's story there. 7 minutes to 1. To the markets now, to Mount Barker for the results of the two-day cattle market. Today, 705 head of cattle were penned for the trade sale, and yesterday there were 1,848 weaners penned for the sale. Tracy Kilner, let's start with a look at the results for the weaner sale.
Numbers were up by 478 from last week, with an outstanding quality yarding of weaner calves offered. Extra heavyweight steers dominated the numbers, easing 10 cents, selling to 456 cents, while the lighter weights gained 10 to 40 cents on demand, topping at 528 cents a kilo. Low numbers of heifers were yarded, reflecting the same quality to gain in all weight categories, selling to a top of 430 cents a kilo. The weaner steers weighing over 400 kilos sold from 320 to 456 cents. Heavyweights made from 428 to 460 cents. Steers under 330 kilos returned 428 to 528 cents. And lighter weights under 280 kilos sold from 462 up to 528 cents. Weaner heifers weighing over 400 kilo range from 384 to 400 cents. Heavyweight sold from 384 to 412 cents. The lighter weights under 330 kilos made from 380 to 422, and weights under 280 kilos made 370 to 430 cents a kilo. Lightweight bullies sold from 294 to 336 cents to feeders and live export buyers. The trade sale today. Yearling steers dominated the yarding, gaining with demand, while a large run of heavyweight cows offered remained firm, and good numbers of heavyweight bulls saw a slight price reduction. The yearling cattle, weighing over 400 kilos, saw steers sell for 410 to 436 cents, while yearling heifers returned 330 to 352 cents a kilo. Grown steers weighing over 400 kilos made 380 to 404 cents. Weights over 500 kilos made 350 to 370 cents. And heavyweights over 600 kilos returned 352 to 366 cents a kilo. The grown heifers weighing under 540 kilos sold from 320 to 390, while the heavy boning room weights returned 336 to 370 cents a kilo. Heavyweight cows were firm at 290 to 338 cents. Medium weight sold from 292 to 304 cents, and store cows made 254 to 298 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls eased, selling from 200 to 334 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. 4-1 to the wool market now, and Andrew Beaton from Nutrien says it was an awesome start to the sales for 2026.
The strongest start actually since 2011.
Wow.
And to give you some idea, we're up 40% compared to this same sale last year.
Wow.
So nationally, on our offering of 37,065 bales, a two-day sale over east, they were up 69 cents on the Tuesday, followed by 38 cents on the Wednesday to be up 107 cents for the week. The indicator there now at 1,648. And the last time we were at that level was January 2020. So we're back to the pre-COVID levels. In the West, we offered 6,497 bales over 2 days. We were up 90 cents on the Tuesday, followed by 32 cents on the Wednesday to be up 131 for the week, and our indicator now at 1,846.
I haven't heard you say those sort of numbers for a long time, and that's pretty phenomenal. I'm assuming that there was little to no resistance.
Bugger all passed in, to be honest. Only 0.7% on the Tuesday, 1.5% passed in on the Wednesday, and usually 15% withdrawn on the first sale on the Tuesday. There might be a few regrets there.
Yeah.
And only 1% withdrawn on the Wednesday.
That's to be expected, that's for sure. Let's go through these claim place lines.
Yeah, 17 micron up 127 to finish at 2,227. 18 micron up 131 to finish at 2,142. These are clean prices I'm talking about. 19 microns up 145 to finish at 2,044. 20 microns up 134 to finish at 1,983. And 21s up 130 to finish at 1,969. So those rises on these are merino fleece lines are all consistent right through. And interesting, even the crossbred fleece was up 30 to 40. So that big rise, crossbred's been pretty stale for a long time.
Mm.
And the cardings were up 78. They're indicated now at 889.
Righto. So oddment lines, I'm assuming they followed suit?
Yeah, similar story. Pieces and bellies Tuesday up 110 to 140 and then followed by Wednesday up 20 to 85 and the fine end being sought after there. Lambs up 120 to 130 on the Tuesday, followed by another rise of 30 cents on the Wednesday. Locks and crutchings up 70 to 90, followed by a 25-cent rise on the Wednesday.
Wow. So I suppose we want to know who's been buying all of this, Andy. They obviously got some cash over Christmas.
Yeah, well, interesting. Over the 2 days in the West, PJ Morris, Techwool Trading and Endeavour Wool were the top three buyers on both days.
Next week, I mean, can this be sustained? What are you expecting?
Well, I'm sort of expecting, because of the rise continuing on the Wednesday, even though it did slow down, I'm expecting and even sort of hoping that it just plateaus out, because I think everyone will be pretty happy at these levels. It's a 2-day sale next week. Nationally, there's 43,326 bales, and in the West, we're offering 8,884, and I would dare say those numbers will be increasing as we speak.
Andrew Beaton going through the wool market with Tara de Landgraft. Great to talk to you this afternoon. Let's get an update from the ABC Newsroom. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.